Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a close look at emergency and disaster nursing. Sort of your backstage pass to understanding how healthcare professionals handle, well, everything from a sudden crisis in the ER to the huge challenges of large-scale disasters. We've gathered some really insightful material that unpacks the immediate priorities, responses to environmental threats, and, you know, the critical actions in disaster scenarios.
Yeah, and our mission today really is to pull out the key actionable knowledge from these sources.
Exactly, giving you a clear, more nuanced understanding of emergency response.
And what's really insightful, I think, from our sources is how they frame emergency nursing. It's not just about treating a condition.
Right.
It's fundamentally collaborative,
yeah.
Holistic even. It includes the patient, obviously, but also their family, significant others.
That definition of emergency stood out to me, too. It's not just about the medical facts, but how the patient or family perceives it.
Precisely. It's their perception of an urgent need that often defines it in the moment.
So it's broader than just the critical life and death stuff we see on TV.
Much broader, yeah. It covers those non-urgent problems, too, the ones that still bring people to the emergency department looking for help.
And navigating that whole range requires a pretty unique skill set.
Absolutely. Emergency nurses have specialized training, education, a lot of experience in managing crises. They're a key part of the team, especially in those high-pressure moments.
And the sources mention challenges, too.
Oh, yeah. Legal issues, occupational health and safety risks, and increasingly being ready for things like mass casualty events, whether from natural causes or, unfortunately, terrorism.
Okay, so let's put in how they actually approach a patient walking through the ER doors. That initial assessment, it seems very structured.
It is, and for good reason. It starts with the primary survey. You might know the acronym AE.
Vaguely. Airway.
Yes. A is airway, establishing a clear, open airway. B is breathing, making sure ventilation is adequate.
Okay.
C is circulation, so checking cardiac output, controlling any major bleeding, treating or preventing shock.
A, B, C.
D is disability. That's a quick check of their neurologic status, often using the AVPU scale, alert, verbal, pain, unresponsive.
AVPU.
And E is exposure. Undressing the patient as needed to fully assess for injuries, and underpinning all of this.
Safety.
Safety, absolutely paramount for the patient and the team.
That makes total sense. Deal with the immediate life threats first. What comes next?
That leads into the secondary survey. This is more comprehensive, a head-to-toe assessment.
Okay.
You get a detailed health history, reassess those ABCs and vital signs constantly, maybe start diagnostic tests, lab work.
Like blood tests and scans.
Exactly. And applying monitoring devices, ECGs, maybe arterial lines, urinary catheters, things like that. Plus interventions like splinting fractures, wound care, giving specific medications.
You mentioned sentinel events earlier. Things to watch out for.
Yes. The materials really highlight two big ones in the ED. Delays in care and medication errors. Those are areas needing constant vigilance.
And it's not just about the medicine, right? There's a human element.
Hugely important. The sources stress patient and family-focused care. Things like, you know, relieving anxiety, providing a sense of security, which can be hard in a chaotic ER.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Allowing family presence when it's appropriate, giving clear explanations about what's happening, that all makes a massive difference to what can be a terrifying experience.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Multiple trauma. Our sources dive into this. What exactly is it?
Multiple trauma refers to a single really catastrophic event that causes life-threatening injuries to at least two different organs or body systems.
Wow. So very serious.
Extremely. It demands a real team approach, highly coordinated. The first job is figuring out the full extent of the injuries and deciding treatment priorities.
Fast.
And there's an assumption made right away.
Yes. You always assume a cervical spine injury until it's definitively ruled out. So immobilization is critical from the get-go.
And the top priority injuries are?
Anything interfering with vital functions, breathing, circulation, those take absolute precedence. Okay. And within trauma, intra-abdominal injuries are mentioned specifically. Sounds dangerous due to bleeding risk.
Very much so. Whether it's blunt trauma, like a car crash, or penetrating, like a stab wound, the abdomen holds major organs and vessels. Massive blood loss is a huge risk.
So how do they assess that?
It involves getting the history of what happened, a thorough physical exam of the abdomen, but also checking other systems, looking for things like referred pain.
Referred pain.
Yeah, like Kara's sign shoulder pain that can indicate bleeding around the spleen or liver. Diagnostics are key too. Lab work, CT scans are common, fast exams.
Yes.
Focused assessment with sonography for trauma. It's a quick ultrasound at the bedside to look for internal bleeding. Sometimes they might do a diagnostic peritoneal lavage or DPL, basically washing out the abdominal cavity to check for blood.
And for stab wounds.
They might use something called sonography, injecting contrast dye into the wound tract to see how deep it goes if it's breached the abdominal cavity.
And the immediate steps for managing these abdominal injuries. It sounds like a lot needs to happen quickly.
It does. Always back to the ABCs first: airway, breathing, circulation. C-spine immobilization is maintained, maybe using a jaw thrust to open the airway without moving the neck.
All right.
Continuous monitoring of vital signs is essential. Documenting wounds carefully if organs are actually protruding.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you cover them immediately with a sterile, moist saline dressing. Keep them viable. The patient gets nothing by mouth NPO. An NG tube might be inserted to decompress the stomach. Tetanus shot. Antibiotics are standard.
And then often surgery.
Very often, yes. Rapid transport to the operating room if needed to stop the bleeding and repair damage.
Okay, another term from the sources, crush injuries. What should we understand about those?
Crush injuries happen when a body part gets compressed between two opposing forces, significant force.
And the assessment findings?
You might see signs of hypovolemic shock, not from bleeding necessarily, but from fluid shifting out of the crushed tissues, potential spinal cord injury if the back was involved. Locally, you'll see redness, blistering, swelling. Fractures are common too.
Any major complications to worry about?
A big one is acute kidney injury, or AKI. When muscle tissue is crushed, it releases substances like myoglobin into the blood, which can damage the kidneys. Rhabdomyolysis is the term for that muscle breakdown.
Right, okay. Let's move to environmental emergencies. Heat stroke, frostbite, hypothermia. Starting with heat stroke, what makes it so critical?
Heat stroke is essentially a catastrophic failure of the body's ability to regulate its own temperature. It can be fatal, fast.
Two types.
Yeah. Yes. Non-exertional, often in vulnerable people during heat waves, and exertional from intense activity in the heat.
Who's most at risk?
People not used to the heat, the very young, the very old, those who are ill or debilitated, and people on certain medications that interfere with sweating or temperature regulation.
And what does it look like?
The key signs are central nervous system dysfunction, confusion, seizures, coma, and a very high core body temperature, usually 105 Fahrenheit, that's 40.5 Celsius, or even higher, often hot and dry in non-exertional cases. But in exertional heat stroke, they might actually still be sweating. Also, rapid breathing, low blood pressure, yeah. Fast heart rate.
And the response needs to be immediate.
Absolutely critical. ABCs first, always. But then rapid cooling is the main goal. Get that core temperature down to around 102 Fahrenheit or 39 Celsius.
How do they do that?
Various ways. Cool sheets, ice packs on major arteries, neck, groin, armpits, cooling blankets. The gold standard, if possible, is immersion in a cold water bath.
Wow. Intense.
It is. And continuous monitoring temperature, vitals, ECG, level of consciousness, urine output. Fave fluids are usually needed for dehydration. Medications might be used for seizures, like anticonvulsants or benzodiazepines for shivering, which can actually generate more heat. Electrolytes like potassium might need replacing too.
Okay. Next, frostbite. What's happening at the tissue level?
Frostbite is basically tissue freezing. Ice crystals form inside and between the cells, drawing water out and causing damage.
But what does it look like?
The skin feels hard, cold, numb. It might look white or kind of mottled blue-white, but importantly, the full extent of the damage often isn't clear right away.
So management.
Controlled rapid rewarming is key, usually in a circulating water bath, precisely temperature controlled around 98.6 to 104 Fahrenheit. That's 37 to 40 Celsius for maybe 30, 40 minutes.
Painful.
Can be very painful as it thaws, so analgesics are important and absolutely crucial. Don't massage or rub the area. That causes more damage. If feet are involved, no walking.
Got it. And the last one in this group, hypothermia. What's the definition?
Hypothermia is defined as a core body temperature of 95 Fahrenheit, 35 Celsius, or lower.
Similar risk groups.
Yes. Older adults, infants, the ill, homeless, trauma victims. Alcohol also increases risk significantly.
And if someone has both hypothermia and frostbite?
Treat the hypothermia first. It's the systemic, life-threatening condition. Frostbite management comes after the core temperature is stable.
Okay, and hypothermia affects the whole body?
Every organ system. It slows everything down, requires really careful, continuous monitoring of heart rhythm, electrolytes, everything.
Management.
Again, ABCs. Remove wet clothing immediately, then rewarming. This can be passive external blankets, warm room, or active.
Active rewarming.
Yes, active core rewarming for moderate to severe cases. Things like warmed 5E fluids, warmed humidified oxygen, maybe even warm fluid lavage of the chest cavity or peritoneum. In extreme cases, cardiopulmonary bypass.
And there's a risk when rewarming.
Yes, something called afterdrop. As the cold blood from the limbs returns to the core, it can actually lower the core temp further and trigger dangerous heart rhythms or electrolyte shifts. So gentle handling is important. Maybe elevate the limbs cautiously.
Okay, let's move into bites and poisoning, a broad category, starting with animal and human bites.
Yeah, main concerns there are infection, looking for pus, redness, tissue death, and tetanus. Need good documentation, photos sometimes.
Treatment.
Thorough cleaning, usually soap and water. Antibiotics are common, and a tetanus booster if needed.
Snake bites, though. Pit vipers specifically are flagged as major emergencies. Why?
Because their venom can cause severe local tissue damage and systemic effects. It's potent stuff. We're talking rattlesnakes, copperheads, water moccasins here in the U.S.
What kind of effects?
Locally. Intense pain, swelling, bruising, maybe those nasty hemorrhagic blisters, tissue death, tender lymph nodes. Systemically. Nausea, vomiting, weird metallic taste, low blood pressure, numbness, tingling, muscle twitching, seizures, even coma. It affects multiple systems, neuro, cardiovascular, respiratory.
So first aid.
Keep the person calm, lying down. Remove tight clothing or jewelry near the bite. Clean the wound gently, light dressing. Immobilize the limb below heart level if possible. Get medical help, ASAP, tetanus update, pain relief.
When in the ED.
Detail history is vital. When did it happen? What symptoms? Contacting poison control is standard practice for expert advice. Continuous vitals, labs, blood counts, clotting studies, urinalysis, 4V fluids for blood pressure support, maybe vasopressors, and the key treatment.
Anti-venom.
Anti-venom, yes. To neutralize the venom, timing can be crucial.
Okay. Spider bites next. Black widow and brown recluse seem quite different.
They are. Black widow venom is neurotoxic. Effects can start quickly, within an hour sometimes. Severe muscle cramps, especially abdominal rigidity like a board, nausea, vomiting, high blood pressure, fast heart rate, pain.
Treatment for black widow?
Ice, elevation, tetanus, pain meds, muscle relaxants, sometimes cardiac monitoring. Anti-venom is available for severe cases.
And brown recluse.
Often painless initially, which is tricky. Later, you might get systemic stuff like fever, chills, nausea, feeling unwell, joint pain. Locally, the bite site gets reddish purple and can develop that characteristic necrotic ulcer tissue death.
So treatment is more local?
Primarily, yes. Wound care is key to prevent infection, promote healing. Sometimes surgical debridement of the dead tissue is needed. Anti-venom isn't typically used for brown recluse in the U.S.
All right, let's broaden out to poisoning in general. What are the main goals of treatment? What are the poison?
Okay, fundamentally, you want to do a few things. One, remove or inactivate the poison, stop more from being absorbed. Two, provide supportive care, keep vital functions going. Three, give a specific antidote if one exists. And four, help the body eliminate the poison faster.
And how they do that depends on how the poison got in. Let's start with ingested poison, swallowed stuff.
Right. Assessment starts with ABCs, vitals, level of consciousness, ECG, urine output monitoring. Labs are crucial. You need to find out what was taken, when, how much, symptoms, patient history, age, weight, faith, all that info is vital.
And management. Reducing absorption.
Several ways. Sometimes inducing vomiting with emetics, but that's less common now and risky with certain substances. Gastric lavage, stomach pumping, maybe in specific early cases. Activated charcoal is used a lot. It binds the poison in the gut. Cathartics might be used to speed things up.
Antidotes.
Yes. If a specific one exists, give it. Then enhancing elimination, maybe forcing fluids for diuresis, dialysis if kidneys fail, or for certain toxins, or hemoperfusion, which filters the blood directly.
And a key caution.
Absolutely do not induce vomiting if someone swallowed a corrosive agent, strong acids, or alkalis. It just burns everything again on the way back up.
The sources mention the Diane Stout case.
Yeah, a grim reminder of intentional poisoning. She used antifreeze. Highlights that you sometimes have to consider poisoning in unexplained illnesses.
Okay, carbon monoxide poisoning. What's unique there?
CO binds to hemoglobin much more strongly than oxygen does. So it basically suffocates the body at a cellular level by blocking oxygen transport.
Symptoms.
Mostly neurological headache, dizziness, confusion, weakness, nausea. Crucially, the skin might look cherry red, not blue, and standard pulse oximeters give falsely high oxygen readings. They're unreliable here.
Treatment.
Get them to fresh air immediately. CPR if needed. The definitive treatment is 100% oxygen, ideally hyperbaric oxygen in a special chamber if available and warranted. That forces the CO off the hemoglobin faster. Continuous monitoring is key.
Chemical burns next. What dictates how bad they are?
Depends on the chemical itself, its type, concentration, how long it was on the skin, how large an area.
Immediate action.
Flush, flush, flush with running water.
Yeah.
Copious amounts for a long time, 15, 20 minutes or even longer. Shower, hose, whatever's available.
Any exceptions?
Yes, important ones. Dry chemicals like lye or white phosphorus, brush them off thoroughly before flushing. Water can actually activate them or generate heat. Also, protect yourself, the rescuer, from the chemical. Try to identify the substance if possible. Follow-up exams are needed.
Okay, last in this section, food poisoning. Usually less dramatic, but common.
Yeah, sudden illness from contaminated food or drink. Management is mostly supportive care, ABCs, though usually stable. Watching for rare but serious things like respiratory paralysis with botulism or certain fish poisonings.
Main treatment.
Replace fluids and electrolytes lost from vomiting or diarrhea. Control nausea. Slowly advance the diet from clear liquids as tolerated. Identifying the source is important for public health, too.
All right, let's make a bigger shift now to disaster nursing. This really broadens the scope, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The nurse's role expands significantly. It's not just direct care, but also being involved in preparedness, the overall response effort. You have to be incredibly adaptable.
What kind of disasters are we talking about?
The sources list a whole range. Mass casualty incidents or MCIs, terrorism, natural disasters, earthquakes, floods, hurricanes, disease outbreaks, epidemics, pandemics, and incidents involving biologic, chemical, nuclear, or radiation agents. It's a wide spectrum.
And managing these involves coordination.
Huge coordination between different agencies, federal, state, local, groups like the Red Cross, specialized teams like MMRT, Metropolitan Medical Response Teams, and the local Office of Emergency Management, OEM. They typically use the Incident Command System, ICS, for structure.
Seems like having a plan is vital. The Emergency Operations Plan, or EOP.
Crucial. Every healthcare facility needs a robust EOP. It covers how the plan gets activated, communication strategies, internal and external, patient care protocols under disaster conditions, security, how to get external resources, managing staff and patient flow, data management.
Wow, comprehensive.
Plans for demobilization afterwards, after action reports to learn lessons, practice drills, resource planning for different scenarios, specific MCI plans, and ongoing staff education. It's a massive undertaking.
So when a disaster hits, how does that plan actually get rolling?
It involves key actions. Rapid patient identification and tagging using triage protocols, managing internal issues like maybe power outages or staff shortages, clear communication with media and families, a huge task. Providing support for families, defining staff roles, which might mean nurses doing tasks outside their usual scope, and critically, managing staff stress.
The sources also mentioned ethical conflicts. That sounds tough.
It is. In disasters, resources are often scarce. These vastly outweigh capacity. This can lead to incredibly difficult ethical dilemmas about rationing care, deciding who gets what, limited resources, resuscitation decisions, aiming for the greatest good for the greatest number, but the choices can be agonizing.
And the psychological toll.
Yeah.
On everyone involved.
Immense. For survivors and responders, anxiety, grief, PTSD are common. For responders, there's also compassion fatigue, burnout. Good disaster plans include mental health support, debriefing, recognizing signs of stress in yourself and colleagues, impaired performance, conflicts, substance use. It has to be addressed.
Let's talk PPE, personal protective equipment. We hear that term a lot now. Different levels.
Yes, essential for protecting responders. Four main levels, A through D. Level A is the highest fully encapsulated suit, self-contained breathing apparatus, SCBA, for unknown or highly toxic vapor hazards.
Level B.
Still uses SCBA for respiratory protection, but the suit is less protective, not vapor tight. For high respiratory risk but lower skin risk.
Level C.
Uses an air purifying respirator, not SCBA, plus chemical resistant clothing, used when the hazard is known and concentrations are within the respirator's limit.
And level D.
Basically a standard work uniform. Minimal protection, maybe gloves, eye protection, not for chemical or respiratory hazards. Choosing the right level depends entirely on the specific threat, chemical, biological, radiological.
Okay, triage. Sorting patients. You mentioned it's different in a disaster.
Yes, very different emphasis. In normal ER triage, the sickest person gets resources first. generally. Mm-hmm. In a mass casualty disaster with limited resources, the goal shifts to saving the maximum number of lives possible.
So prioritizing those most likely to survive with the resources available.
Exactly. It's sometimes called reverse triage, but the principle is maximizing survival across the group. They use color codes. Red is immediate life-threatening injuries, but survivable with quick intervention. Yellow is delayed serious injuries, need care, but can wait a bit.
Green.
Green is minor, the walking wounded, can wait longer or go elsewhere. And black is expectant or deceased injuries are so severe they're unlikely to survive given the available resources, or they're already dead.
What kind of injuries fall into red?
Things like airway compromise that can be fixed, uncontrolled bleeding, shock, severe burns covering maybe 15-40% of the body, open long bone fractures, things needing immediate intervention to save life or limb.
And black?
Catastrophic injuries, massive head trauma with no signs of life, devastating burns over, say, 60% of the body, no pulse, no breathing despite attempts, really grim decisions sometimes. The SALT system is one specific method for doing this sorting.
The sources mention waves of hospital arrivals after natural disasters.
Yeah, it's a common pattern. First wave, usually the walking wounded, people with minor injuries who get there on their own fairly quickly.
Second wave.
Arrives a bit later, often transported by EMS or others. These tend to be people with more severe injuries.
And third.
These are victims who might be found or rescued later, potentially trapped. They often have very serious, complex injuries and may have been exposed to the elements for longer.
And those walking wounded still need support.
Absolutely. Even if their physical injuries are minor, they need shelter, water, food, information, psychological support, maybe even help with pets. Addressing their needs is part of the overall response.
Okay, just briefly wrapping up with outbreaks, epidemics, pandemics, and weapons of terror.
Right. An outbreak is just more cases of a disease than expected. An epidemic is a larger outbreak, often from a single source, spreading widely in a community. A pandemic is an epidemic gone global across countries or continents. Identifying the source and stopping spread is key.
And weapons of terror.
Using violence to create fear for political or ideological goals can involve blast injuries with primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary effects depending on the blast wave, projectiles being thrown, and other related injuries.
Or other agents.
Yes. Biologic weapons like smallpox or anthrax, chemical weapons, vesicants that blister, nerve agents, blood agents that stop oxygen use, and nuclear radiation exposure all require specialized knowledge and response.
Wow. That's an incredibly detailed overview. It really paints a picture of emergency and disaster nursing as, well, intense and demanding.
It absolutely is. It requires that blend of sharp assessment skills, like the ABCDE approach, understanding specific threats like heat stroke or snake bite, and then being able to scale up and adapt for huge events like disasters.
That ability to adapt seems crucial.
And maintaining that collaborative, patient-focused approach even when everything is chaotic. Keeping the person and their family at the center, despite the pressure.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, it's clear this field is dynamic, challenging, incredibly important. Considering everything we've touched on, from the individual patient in the ER to the community-wide disaster, what single factor do you think is most critical for an effective response?
That's a tough one.
Is it the meticulous planning, the depth of individual knowledge and skills, the ethical compass guiding those hard choices, or maybe something else entirely, like communication or leadership?
Yeah, they're all so interconnected, aren't they? Perhaps it boils down to preparedness at all levels, but informed by strong ethical grounding and constant learning.
Definitely something profound to think about. Thank you for joining us for this edition of The Deep Dive.